Hamas fired several rockets into Israel after it warned Tel Aviv to withdraw its forces from the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Israel intensifies its violent crackdown on Palestinians at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, with more than 300 Palestinians injured only on Monday. And India registers more than 366,000 new infections and a further 3,700 deaths. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says it fired rockets at Israel shortly after explosions were heard in Jerusalem Al-Quds. Hamas did not elaborate on the operation, but it earlier warned Israel that it would face escalation over its crackdown against Palestinians in the city. Hamas had given a deadline to the regime to withdraw its forces by 1500 GMT from the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and a nearby neighborhood in Jerusalem Al-Quds. The Israeli military confirmed 7 rockets were fired from the Gaza Strip that landed at Jerusalem Al-Quds and nearby areas. The military said more rockets were landing in southern Israel. Palestinian media also said that Israel carried out missile strikes in the northern Gaza Strip, causing injuries. Let's get an idea from both of our correspondents who are joining us for this special coverage, Ashraf Shannon from Gaza City. We also have Mona Kandil, who joins us from occupied Ramallah. First, over to you, Ashraf Shannon. We know that rockets have been fired from the Gaza Strip. If you can tell us how many, what has happened, and also the fact that Israel has retaliated with rocket fire from their side, and we understand some casualties have occurred as a result.
Well, there's the Palestinian resistance groups, mainly the Ezzedin Qassam Brigades, Hamas's military wing, and the Al-Quds Brigades, Islamic Jihad military wing, have confirmed firing rockets towards the Israeli regime in retaliation for the Israeli violations and attacks and aggressions on Palestinians in Jerusalem Al-Quds, as well as the holy sites in Jerusalem Al-Quds. Around 5 p.m. Local time today, the Hamas top military commander put a deadline for the Israeli regime to de-escalate and occupy Jerusalem Al-Quds by 6 p.m. local time. That was about an hour ago. And apparently the Israeli regime did not heed these warnings. So the Palestinian resistance factions began firing rockets towards the Israeli regime. And earlier today, Palestinian factions again warned the Israeli regime against the attacks on Jerusalem Al-Quds. So far, the Israeli regime has responded to the rocket fire by carrying out at least 2 airstrikes in northern Gaza. There are casualties, most likely children. We're still waiting for more details to come in.
Mona Kandil, we understand that rockets have landed in Jerusalem Al-Quds or the surrounding areas, and also the fact that Israel has retaliated. Tell us information that you have on those incidents.
According to the Israeli media, rockets aren't sounded in central Israel that has occupied and in Jerusalem Al-Quds exactly at 6 o'clock after at the time thousands of Israeli settlers were parading through Jerusalem Al-Quds on Jerusalem Day. It seems that the Israelis didn't take seriously the threats of the Hamas movement and its military wing. The Israeli military said that 7 rockets were fired towards Israel. 1 was intercepted by the Ireland missile defense system. Also, the Israelis are saying that an inhabited building was struck by one of the rockets, and a fire broke out in another settlement. These settlements around the Gaza Strip, Sderot and Ascalon, were also hit by the rockets that Hamas movement claimed responsibility for. There was a session for the Israeli Knesset, but immediately as the sound of the sirens, the members of the Knesset were ordered to immediately leave.
Okay, very well. Israel has intensified its violent crackdown on Palestinians in the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound amid escalating tensions in Jerusalem outlets. Israeli troops fired rubber-coated bullets, tear gas, and sound bombs at Palestinian worshippers. The Palestinian Red Crescent says that more than 300 Palestinians were wounded and that several of them are in serious conditions. Over the past days, hundreds of people have been injured in Israel's crackdown on protests against planned evictions of Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in East Al-Quds. The Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has condemned Israel for its quote brutal storming and assault on worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque. Reactions are pouring in over violent clashes in Jerusalem Al-Quds sparked by Israel's attacks on Al-Aqsa Mosque and its planned eviction of Palestinian families. The UN chief says that Israel must exercise maximum restraint and respect the right to freedom of peaceful assembly. Antonio Guterres has urged Israel to cease demolitions and evictions. Iran has again expressed its solidarity with the Palestinians, calling on the UN and other international bodies to confront Israeli violations. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh said the Islamic world needs to respond more than ever to the Israeli brutality. Turkey has warned that Israel bears sole responsibility for any violence, calling on Tel Aviv to stop attacking Palestinians and prevent settlers from entering Al-Aqsa Mosque. Commentator Mick Knapp here says the storming of Al-Aqsa Mosque sends a clear message of the ongoing ethnic cleansing against the Palestinians.
This attack is sending a signal to people around the world that not even the Al-Aqsa Mosque is exempt from Israeli appetites. They don't want Palestinians there. They want a so-called Jewish temple there to replace the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And the pressure is relentless. This is the ethnic cleansing carried on without a break, but concentrated on the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The cruelty is transparent. And sad to say, the usual charade is beginning. There's condemnation of what Israel is doing. But these governments are not talking about action to make Israel stop.
The final list of candidates eligible to run for the upcoming presidential elections in Syria have been announced. Three candidates will be competing this month on leading Syria for the next 7 years. Our correspondent Muhammad Ali has more from Damascus.
Here at the Higher Constitutional Court, the final list of those eligible to participate in Syria's presidential elections has been announced. This comes after a week from the initial announcement, which was a period of time given for objections, which reached six. All have been declined.
The court rejected all objections due to the lack in the legal and constitutional terms of their applications. Thus, the final announcement is as follows. The court has accepted Abdullah Abdullah, Bashar al-Assad and Mahmoud Meri as the final candidates in the upcoming presidential elections.
Abdullah Abdullah is a former MP and Mahmoud Meri is a Syria-based opposition figure. According to the court, candidates are allowed to start campaigning on the 16th of May. 10 days before the date of the elections in Syria. However, individuals and even public and private bodies have already filled the streets of President Assad posters in a wide show of support that indicates who is likely to win. Presidential elections this year are different from any previous ones from many aspects.
I expect a large participation by voters this year because so many parts of the country have become secure and under government control. We have three candidates and Syrians will decide who the winner is.
Previous elections were more difficult from today during the war because of terrorist mortar attacks. Today I see Syrians more excited to take part in elections and vote.
This is an unprecedented election process in Syria's history, as for the first time, more than 50 persons applied to become a candidate, among them women. In April, the People's Assembly officially announced the date of the elections, including the terms that should be met for those who wish to run, which included the votes of at least 35 MPs. All eyes are on the presidential elections in Syria, a process carried out according to the country's constitution. Despite the fact that so many countries known for their hostility to Syria are against the elections, the Syrian government is keen to abide by the law and send a message that only the Syrian people are entitled to decide the future of their country. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Malaysia has announced a month-long nationwide lockdown to tackle a new surge in coronavirus cases. Prime Minister Mohiuddin Yassin said all educational institutes will be closed and all social gatherings will be banned. All interstate and interdistrict movement will also be halted, except for emergencies. This as the country logged more than 3,800 new cases, bringing the total to above 440,000. Meanwhile, in India, daily coronavirus cases and fatalities slightly retreated from recent record highs. the health ministry reported over 366,000 new infections and more than 3,700 deaths Monday. The pandemic has claimed nearly a quarter of a million lives in India. A ceasefire has been declared between the Afghan government and the Taliban for this week's Eid al-Fitr holiday, which marks the end of the fasting month of Ramadan. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed this topic further with our guests. Let's take a listen. So it's time now for the news review of this bulletin. The Afghan government and the Taliban declared a three-day ceasefire for this week's Eid al-Fitr holiday, which marks the end of the fasting month of Ramadan. The Taliban announced a halt to all offensive operations on Monday. That was reciprocated by Afghan President Ashraf Ghani later in the day. Ghani also urged the militants to announce a permanent truce. This comes amid a recent rise in violence following the U.S. failure to meet its declared deadline of May 1st to fully withdraw its forces from Afghanistan. On Sunday night, a bomb blast hit a bus in the southeastern province of Zabul, killing at least 11. It followed a multiple bomb blast on Saturday outside of a school in the capital, Kabul. That attack killed scores of people, most of them little girls. Amin Alami is a correspondent joining us from Afghanistan's capital, Kabul. We have Saeed Mohsin Abbas, who's a journalist and political commentator, joining us from London. Amin Alami, what is the latest that we have regarding Afghanistan? What are we seeing anything new there, unfortunately?
Of course, Afghanistan is witnessing rising insecurity, particularly over the recent weeks. For instance, as you mentioned, nearly 70 civilians, most of them schoolgirls, lost their lives, and over 150 others wounded as a result of back-to-back explosions that happened in a Shia-dominated Dasht-e-Barchi area of western Kabul. Only 2 days after this deadly attack that was rejected by the Taliban militant group, and the rest of the terrorist groups have also not commented regarding to this incident and have not claimed responsibility for it. The Afghan presidential palace released a statement saying that the Afghan president has declared Tuesday as a national mourning day as a show of respect to the victims of this inhuman and deadly attack on the defenseless civilians, mainly on school girls in western part of Kabul. In the meantime, the Taliban also declared a three-day ceasefire on the occasion of the arrival of Eid al-Fitr. That is a very important occasion among Muslims across the world. In response to this declaration by the Taliban, the Afghan government in a statement says that temporary ceasefire cannot be a solution for the Afghan conflict. It says that the statement, says that the Taliban have now realized that they will not win the war via insisting on military ways because, according to the statement of the Afghan presidential palace, as well as according to top military officials here in Kabul, the Afghan National Security and Defense Forces are now capable to independently launch military operations and pound terrorist groups.
Okay, so we're looking at Saeed Mohsin Abbas, instability in Afghanistan. We're looking at what happened regarding those schoolgirls. At the same time, we're looking at what the U.S. has said and how it's been reported that they are actually withdrawing their forces along with the coalition forces from that country. But then when we look at the fine details, we're looking at how there are reports that they're going to be thousands and thousands of contractors that will remain in that country, and also the fact that the U.S. is actually looking at another at other options for a military base since they are so-called withdrawing themselves. They're looking perhaps at Tajikistan, etc., based on some reports. Is the U.S. serious about this withdrawal and the way that it has announced that? Because it looks like they're just repositioning themselves.
No, not at all. The Americans are not serious whatsoever. They will not let their fingers out of the pie that is Afghanistan. People underestimate the value of resources tucked away in Afghanistan, which amounts to trillions, trillions and trillions. And they also have the drug, the drugs trade, which has largely been expanded during the U.S. period in, if you like, oppression of the Afghani people. So you can see there are many, many factors in terms of just economically why they don't want to leave there. But of course, geopolitically, they don't want to leave the region because they need continued pressure on the Islamic Republic of Iran. A set policy objective of bringing down the government in Iran is facilitated by the Americans surrounding Iran effectively by being in Afghanistan. It's also necessary for them to destabilize Pakistan in that region. The Americans do not want a nuclear-powered Pakistan to be living free and easy. So, of course, they've maintained a physical presence, which has cost them quite dearly, and they haven't really achieved any of the objectives that they pretended they were going there for. Terrorism, etc., all a load of lies. The reality of it is that now, because they're pulling out actually visibly or actually on the surface, what they've been doing for quite some time is they've been facilitating the influence of ISIS affiliates and ISIS fighters from Syria, Iraq, and other regions, and they've been flooding Afghanistan with these fighters in order to become a proxy force, and that's exactly what they've got now. Earlier on this year, even the U.S. Central Command's General Kenneth Frank McKenzie, who actually oversees the U.S. forces in Afghanistan, he told a virtual forum there that there was no doubt that the IS Khorasan, which is what they're called, the ISIS in Afghanistan, will again be able to hold territory as it once did. You know, they obviously had inside information. I wonder where they got that. But the group, basically, as far as they're concerned, maintains a steady operational tempo, and he said then that probably retains the ability to conduct attacks in Kabul and other urban centers. This was in January this year. Lo and behold, just as they announced they're leaving, they've unleashed their attack dogs. They're letting them loose to cause chaos and mayhem, and to basically also threaten the government in Kabul that they cannot survive without collaborating with America, with or without the soldiers there. They have to do as they're told. And at the same time, they're sending the message to the Taliban that the Taliban can't have a free run in Afghanistan. They're going to have ISIS and other terrorist groups financed, trained by the Americans to deal with.
Thank you very much for that, Saeem Hossein Abbas, journalist and political commentator. I'd also like to thank our correspondent, Amin Alami, there from Kabul. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Allahumma Rabb شهر رمضان.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, the importance of charity. Brothers and sisters, we know that charity is not limited to just financial and economic benefit to others. The scope of charity is wider than just giving money in the way of Allah. While giving money is one of the open manifestations of this charity, there are other forms of charity too. You teach Quran to someone. Even teaching sciences to someone else is considered to be charity, if you're doing it for the right reasons and, of course, for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, helping family in need. It is acceptable to give one's charity to those in need in one's own family. The Prophet said, to give something to a poor man brings one reward, while giving the same to a needy relation brings two, one for charity and the other for respecting the family ties. The pitfall of greed. Be careful of greed. The longer one holds on to money and fails to share it as charity, the harder it may be later on to part with that hoarded wealth. Hiding away one's wealth and depriving the needy of even a small kindness will not only come back to haunt the greedy, but their misfortune will be multiplied and they will be led down a misguided path. So remember not to get attached to that wealth of yours. Be very careful out there, especially brothers, you know, who are earning, or even sisters who are earning. You have that wealth, don't get attached to it, because it makes it harder for you and me and all of us to leave this world. You know, when people cannot leave this world, it's because of their attachment, and that time is very difficult.
رمضان المستبين جاء بالنور المبين رمضان 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 القانتين.
Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the importance of charity, and we discussed about helping family in need, the pitfall of greed, and now let's talk about charity that keeps on giving. So there's this concept, this beautiful concept rather, in Islam, which is charity that keeps on giving. It's also called sadaqah jariyah. Now, if a person performs a deed that continues to benefit others in a good way, the performer of the deed will continue to collect the rewards for her single act for as long as it benefits others, even after the person passes away. This is referred to as the charity that keeps giving, and it's also known as perpetual charity. Now, charity serves as a way to bring justice, balance, and kindness to every society and community. It is our hope that the Muslim community fulfills their charitable duty correctly and does their part to eliminating poverty in communities everywhere. And it could be, again, the poverty of wealth, or the poverty of knowledge, the poverty of ideology, the poverty of spirituality, and all of those things that a society requires to nourish. And just imagine, if the Muslim countries, they start to look at this concept of Islam and adopt it, Islamic world can be a different place to live in. Islamic countries would be a different and a very strong bloc. But unfortunately, we are overwhelmingly occupiers like Saudis, right? These dictators who are eating and digesting the wealth of Muslims but not using it for Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. But you know that there will be better, there will be stronger. Few of them
the subcontinent.
Hi everyone, this is John and I welcome you back to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations and the region of South Asia as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about the International Quds Day across the subcontinent. And we shall take a look at the Israeli atrocities against the Palestinians and the role of world's Muslims and non-Muslims in the actualization of the Palestinian cause.
Since 1947, when the British Mandate ended on Palestine, Israel has committed crimes against the Palestinians that are unprecedented in modern history. Palestinians are humiliated, kidnapped, tortured, and killed in their own land while struggling with this new type of colonization in the name of settlements. Many global organizations, including the European Union, the United Nations, and the International Court of Justice, recognize these settlements as illegal, but nobody seems to do anything about them.
Every year on the International Quds Day, Muslims and non-Muslims across the subcontinent hold protests to further the Palestinian cause and end the Israeli occupation. Quds Day is an opportunity to unite all the Islamic community behind this beacon of hope and leads the Ummah to subcontinental unity and even global unison. However, Palestinians remain one of the most oppressed communities in the world, while the world tends to remain silent. Many countries and governments that call themselves torchbearers of freedom and liberty are silent. Even though US has vetoed more than 20 UN resolutions for Israel and bullied most governments into remaining silent, millions of people from all around the world, including the subcontinent, mark the International Quds Day as a symbol of resistance and protest against the illegitimate Israeli regime and its crimes against the Palestinians.
What we see that in Iran and its neighboring countries and some of the European and West countries where some substantial number of Muslims are residing for a couple of decades there, the voice in favor of Palestine under the banner of Quds Day has had been gradually increased, which is a very, very good sign.
The fate of the Palestinian cause is especially interconnected with the people of the Asian plateau. The history of occupation and exploitation in the western and eastern parts of the continent share uncanny similarities. The Indian subcontinent can play a vital role in better actualization of the Palestinian cause. In addition to the Indian and Pakistani Muslims who have been supporting a free Palestine for a long time, myriads of ethno-linguistic and religious majorities and minorities of the region have also voiced some sort of support for it.
Every Quds Day, millions of people all around the world, including the West, hold large protest rallies against the policies of the Zionist regime. Although the COVID pandemic has made many of these protests virtual, the agony in the lives of Palestinians has become more real. The heinous crimes of Israel are not emotionally charged overstatements. Israeli oppression is well documented. Only in 2014 alone, more than 2,300 Palestinians were killed, and so far, more than 65,000 Palestinian citizens are said to have been killed by the Israeli forces in total. Gaza is under complete blockade since 2007. Almost 2 million people are under constant threat of bombardment of even their schools and hospitals. They face a famine with no money or clean water amid the deadly outbreak of the coronavirus. Then, when Palestinians protest, Israeli forces mercilessly fire live ammunition at them, killing children, women, journalists, medical aid workers, and even handicapped people. Israel has now increased the occupation of the West Bank territory. Israelis keep forcing native Arab Muslims out of their homes before bulldozing their property, only to build new settlements. They do this even though the settlements are considered illegal, and Israel has been declared an apartheid regime by UN and prominent international leaders, as well as human rights organizations from all around the world.
Seeing Quds Day as the great unifier that it is can also help find more feasible solutions for other problems of the subcontinental Islamic population. Imagine what feats of human accomplishment might be possible if India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, and the rest of South Asia act as one. With that scope of support and cooperation, even the complex, intractable issues of the Muslim world, including Kashmir or Rohingya, seem solvable.
Since the early years of the 20th century, colonial powers have been masters of the so-called divide-and-rule dogma to prolong their rule. The partition of Palestine to create the Zionist entity in the midst of the 20th century occurred just 1 year after British India was partitioned to create Pakistan. It is always seen as the legacy of British imperialism in South Asia. The Israeli regime illegitimately and illegally took control of Palestine with the help of imperial superpowers and expelled millions of Palestinians from their homes, while kept the rest as hostages in their own lands. The people of the subcontinent can sympathize with the pains that Palestinians feel as a result of the same policy of division, which is exacerbating disarray in the Islamic community to flare up the conflicts around the globe in order to avert attention from the current issues of the Muslim world. Reminding us the roots and similarities in today's world problems, the Quds Day is when we become mindful that Palestine can be a key to enable the Muslims to stand behind each other for a greater cause, a global unity.
The Muslims in the subcontinent, they consider it very, very compulsory, and they think one of their most important obligation to concerned about the Palestinian Muslims when they see about the different kind of the Israeli aggression and the injustices towards the innocent Palestinians. So there is always a very strong voice that is that has been raised from the subcontinent Muslims, and they always support the Palestine cause, and they always have a very strong sentiments for the Palestinian Muslims.
As far as the Pakistan is concerned, they retaliated, and especially in the last one decade, they have retaliated their stand for not accepting Israel as a nation. And they are in support of Palestine for freedom. If we see the recent statements of Prime Minister of Pakistan, Imran Khan. But their ties with the Muslim world, in Arab world, which have ties with Israel, there's no, we do not see any complete picture, any right picture when the Pakistan raised its voice for Palestinian freedom.
The call for Palestinian freedom by the late father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, has been echoed throughout the subcontinent ever since. The father of the Indian nation, Mahatma Gandhi, has also famously said that Palestine belongs to the Palestinians in the same sense that England belongs to the English or France to the French. Quds Day is an epitome of unanimity among the Muslims as well as all the oppressed human beings would hopefully ripple out across the subcontinent, throughout Asia, and finally, all over the world.
Protesting for the rights of the oppressed people of Palestine is not just a duty, it is a moral reaction by every human who has a conscience. But if people all around the world protest against Israel, the regime calls them the anti-Semitic, despite the fact that even the UN describes Israel an apartheid regime and Jewish people all around the world condemn the systematic, institutionalized discrimination against Palestinians based on religion and ethnicity.
This is the message to the Israel and Americans to make an end to the innocent killing of the people and the innocent children of the Palestine as well as of the Yemen as well.
Al-Quds Day is one of the major dedication and the day in which the Muslims around the world actually they pledge for the rights of the Palestinians, because if you see after the Balfour Declaration, so the majority of the Arab countries they have been compromising on the Palestine cause. And they are pushing behind this Palestine issue, because if you have details and read about the Balfour Declaration, so it's very clear that without the support of the Arab countries, it was not possible for the Israel to make a separate land and to occupy the Palestine. So this Quds Day actually is one of the day that is has been still giving a message to the whole world that the Muslims stand for the Palestinians and for Palestine.
The International Quds Day provides a small window of opportunity for all the people to open their eyes and ears to the plight of Palestinians, who are victims of killings, displacement, desecration, and various forms of settlers and military attacks. Each year on the last Friday of Ramadan, the world has a chance to transcend Quds Day forever. In the long string of annual Quds demos, only one will be different. The Quds Day that will start celebrating the free Palestine and the entailing harmony that unites all the Islamic world.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to better understand the situation of Palestinians and the International Quds Day from the perspective of the people of the subcontinent, we have with us Mr. Muhammad Shafiq. He's the CEO of the Ramadan Foundation. Mr. Shafiq, welcome to this show. So firstly, can the Indian subcontinent play a better role in the actualization of the Palestinian cause? And what special role can the Muslims and non-Muslims of the subcontinent play to support Palestinians in their way to freedom?
Yeah, I mean, already in Pakistan, there is a deep-rooted love and appreciation for the Palestinian people, and that's gone on for decades, particularly because of the struggle against Indian-occupied Kashmir, and so that's the thing that binds people together. But yeah, there's lots more that can be done. I think it's great that Pakistan has refused to recognize Israel until there's a Palestinian state, unlike some of the Arab states that have gone ahead with their former relationship. So that is something good. But yeah, I think civic society needs to step up. and show solidarity against occupation and the oppression of the Palestinian people. Because I actually think, on the whole, for example, in India, the vast majority of people stand with the Palestinian people, unlike the people in government and the powers to be who stand with Israel. So it's really important to raise the voice of the struggle of the Palestinians.
Okay, so can the Quds Day unify Muslims across the subcontinent, Asia, or even the world? How can the Quds Day work as a unifying occasion for all the Muslims across the subcontinent and the world?
Well, I think the first thing that we have to do on Quds Day is be very clear that we are very proud of our association with the Palestinian people. And we're not going to allow people to throw accusations of anti-Semitism just because they don't want to look at the record of the Israeli forces in killing innocent Palestinians. And that record goes back 70 years. There are people who've been killed. And so around the world, it's an opportunity to highlight the struggle of the Palestinian cause. And regardless of why the governments in the Middle East have relationships with Israel, on the whole, we stand with the Palestinian people until they are free.
So, Mr. Shafiq, our team has collected a few global media coverages in this regard. And I would really appreciate that before moving ahead, you could take a look maybe at how the situation has been, and then we can move ahead. Thank you.
Kashmir and Palestine have a similar historical beginning of their dispute. Palestinian history with Israel as a settler colonial occupation went back to the British colonization of Palestine, British declared Balfour Declaration on 1917. This declaration established the idea of creating a new state in Palestine for Jews and brought with it the project of Israel occupation. Moreover, in 1947, the United Nations approved a plan for the partition of Palestine into a Jewish and an Arab state. Jerusalem was to be internationalized. The Jews accepted the plan, but the Arabs did not. Israel was declared as an independent state on May 14, 1948. This indicates British colonization as the main start point for both the occupation of Palestine and Kashmir, and it also clarified the territorial partition plans that had been existed in both contexts. Prominent voices have warned for years that apartheid lurks just around the corner if the trajectory of Israel's rule over Palestinians does not change, said Kenneth Roth, executive director of Human Rights Watch. This detailed study shows that Israeli authorities have already turned that corner and today are committing the crimes against humanity of apartheid and persecution. The Palestinian National Movement was in a difficult situation before four Arab states normalized relations with Israel, largely because of its internal divisions. These moves by the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan, all driven by considerations completely unrelated to Palestine, make its situation more difficult. According to all reputable surveys, however, Arab public opinion does not approve of the moves by these four states and is still supportive of the Palestinians, says historian Rashid Khalidi, the Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University.
Mr. Shafiq, thank you so much for staying with us and welcome back. So, how do you think the governments of India and Pakistan can help the Palestinian cause?
Well, I think, as I've already said, the Pakistani government is very much in support of the Palestinian cause, but actually needs to step up by using its influence in the Middle East with some of those Arab countries that have restored relationships with Israel to highlight the struggle of the Palestinian cause. I think Pakistan's in a really good position because of its advocacy and support for the Kashmiri cause and the occupation that the Kashmiri people are suffering, for them to be able to do the similar things for Pakistan, for Palestine on an international stage at the United Nations, at various global bodies, and use their diplomatic power to raise that voice. In terms of India, you obviously see, as I said, the people of India are very much in support of the Palestinian cause, but the government is not, and I think there's going to be pressure put on the government to highlight the issue. You know, this is not about all Israelis. This is not about all, you know, targeting a particular faith community. This is about highlighting the injustice of occupation that the Palestinians have suffered for these past 70 plus years and giving them an independent, viable state.
Mr. Shafiq, what's bothering many people's mind is that how can the long history of partition and division by colonial powers in the subcontinent influence the sentiments of Indians, Muslim or not, towards the Palestinian cause? Do you see any similarities between the fate of Indian Muslims and Palestinians?
Yeah, I think there is a connection between the experience of the Palestinians to what the Indian Muslim community, but also the Hindu community and the Sikh community faced at the time of partition, when Muslim families went towards Pakistan and Hindu and Sikh families went towards India. The difference is, in Palestine, those people weren't allowed to come back home. They were made stateless. The Palestinians were kicked out of their home, their homes, their towns, their lands, and weren't allowed to return. They were refugees in neighboring countries. In India, if they hadn't lost their life in that violence, they were given a new home in India and were able to settle and contribute and make a life for themselves. Well, the Palestinians won't be able to do that. They won't be able to return to Gaza or the West Bank or Jerusalem. And I think that's something that we need to continuously highlight.
Mr. Shafiq, thank you so much for being with us on our show. I wish you the best of happiness and safety from coronavirus during this time. All right. Now, social media has also been riled up regarding the Palestinian cause and about the Quds Day particularly. So let's just take a quick look.
A Weighted Hope has touched on the issue of COVID pandemic and expressed hope that they would be allowed to hold an actual and non-virtual protest rally in their community. Yasha Naqvi has summarized the spirit of the Quds Day in a succinct and beautiful way. He says the holy month of Ramadan is about freedom from bad things. This is why Quds is the day of Palestinians' freedom from the occupation. Aliyu Ibrahim Ajia has asked all the Muslims in the world to join hands for the oppressed people. Ali Haydar talks about how the hunger during the fasting days of Ramadan reminds us of the hunger Palestinians suffer under Israeli military rule. Al-Aqil Jawad has quoted the father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, to point out that the Quds Day means the rise of all the voiceless people around the globe.
Right, that was our special episode for the International Quds Day and its unifying force across the Muslim world. We shall meet again next week.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Proper Nutrition with Brother Sayyid Vahid Alavi in the program The Month of Allah.
Assalamu alaikum everyone, this is Sayyid Wahid and welcome to the month of Allah. In these programs during the holy month of Ramadan, we have tried to give you nutrition tips, Ramadan tips about what to eat and what to try to avoid eating. And I hope inshallah ta'ala that you will continue with the nutrition tips that we have given you in the holy month of Allah after Ramadan also. And now we're reaching the end of the holy month of Ramadan, and inshallah ta'ala I hope that these programs have been very, very pleasurable for all of you inshallah ta'ala, and especially useful. The diets during Ramadan, that the food items that we eat, our diet, it should be the same or almost the same as before Ramadan. So no fundamental changes should happen during Ramadan. What we need to concentrate more on is what to eat and how much carbohydrates it has, and what to drink and so on and so forth that we mentioned, and that the food items should be able to, the body should be able to digest all of those food items that we consume between 3 to 5 hours. Late digestive food items like grains and lentils and whole wheat flour, rice, these are examples of late digestive food items that you can consume or bear at the time of Sahari at dawn. And we have early digestive food items also, which includes sugar, white flour and the like. Foods containing fiber include bran foods, whole wheat, cereals, various vegetables such as green beans, peas, corn, spinach, and beet leaves, skin fruits, and so on and so forth. And these are things that should be noticed when you want to start your sahari or at dawn, because they can help you profoundly during your fast. This was all for this time, and I hope that you enjoyed the program. Till next time, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you. Ramadan Kareem.
وصفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.